Is this on?
Yes.
Oh. Well, I wish to thank Tufts and the organizers, and especially Professor Seiko, for organizing this whole event. And I'm sure I speak on behalf of all the invited speakers and guests that this is an important event for us. And I hope it will be for you as well. And we're very grateful, I am, that I've been invited to speak to you this morning. Now, on unconventional warfare, a lot was said yesterday already, so I don't have to go into much detail. It includes insurgencies, guerrilla terror group activities, and of course the state security forces' response to these events, these challenges, and also outside state interventions, both of a kind that fuels the conflict and also the kind that is more on the peacekeeping, peacebuilding side. So this is the topic I want to cover. In particular, how do democratic states actually fight insurgents and cope with terrorist groups and conduct this asymmetric warfare that we talked about yesterday at great length? And in particular, the criteria I use is, to what degree do the state's response conform to the Geneva Conventions and the laws of war on the military side, and to what degree does the response of democratic states use a crisis or emergency justice system that is different from normal peacetime justice? Now, the empirical finding, by studying sort of a quantitative analysis of the last 20, 25 years, 150 states, and the like, there's several studies that have been done. They classify states by degree of democratic, having a democratic system, and also you measure the degree of a crisis that occurs. And the finding is that all states modify their peacetime normal response and engage in a certain amount of crisis justice, and on the military front deviate from Geneva Convention standards. Democratic states do it just as much, maybe not to the same extent, but they do it as frequently as the non-democratic states. So that's a basic given, a finding that I wish to point out to you. Secondly, I will just focus on democratic states. I'm not going to talk about, and I haven't really studied, how the Algerian military government and state responded to the Islamist challenge, nor how Indonesia responded or acted in the East Timor case, and or the Serb state reacted to in the Bosnian and Croatian war. I want to focus it pretty much on things that I know better and I studied, which is especially the U.S., the U.K., and I have some material from on France and so on, but I don't have time to cover that here. So what is the degree of mode or the amount of deviation or nonconformity matters a great deal for containing the insurgency, for reaching a political settlement, and building a stable peace. That is, I'm not just looking at how much damage is done to civilians and death and destruction, but I'm also looking at the outcomes of using different modes of fighting democratic states fighting the insurgents, and some modes or deviations are at high risk of bringing about a failed state, anarchy, warlordism, and chaos, essentially, which makes a political settlement very difficult, if not impossible, and doesn't look good then for the country on the peace-building end, no matter what happens. Whereas other modes of fighting insurgents create a better chance for bringing about a political settlement and keeping or maintaining a state that can function during peace building rather than producing anarchy and chaos. So the outcomes that we would like, of course, is a political settlement, a stable peace, and a functioning state that can be used to reconstruct after the damage of insurgency and civil war. Now, here I'm going to say something perhaps a little bit controversial, and I hope so. I mean, I purposely do that. If a state, a democratic state, wins a military victory by using 100% police state methods, in other words, using state terror against insurgent terror, a somewhat total warfare like the French did during the Algerian War of Independence, then the outcome ceases, whatever the outcome is, you don't end up with democracy, and you probably end up with a repressive society and government, and you're just preparing for another round, maybe in the next generation or the next 10 years, of another revolt, another insurgency in which you repeat the same cycle of violence without ending to coming to some kind of a resolution. However, and maybe this is important, if the democratic states and security forces, they never do, but if they were to adhere 100% to peacetime justice and 100% to the Geneva Convention, the insurgents win. And if the insurgents win, you have ethnic cleansing, the moderates get intimidated and killed, the best middle-class people and youth emigrate from this country, the rest of the citizens arm and form defensive militias, and you get a kind of a criminal warlord state if the insurgents win. And the probability of them winning increases if there were total 100% adherence to international norms of warfare on the part of the democratic state. Now, in between, where you have a certain deviation from the Geneva Convention norms, and also you introduce crisis justice system that deviates from normal peacetime justice, and you engage in some violations of human rights and peacetime standards, you have actually a better chance of bringing the state, that is the democratic state, has a better chance of containing the insurgency, which then opens the way for a political solution. A peace has a chance because the state is not destroyed during this process of counterinsurgency and peacemaking. And you create a secure population and a possibility of development and investment aid to reconstruct the country. So the mode of intervention by a democratic state in insurgency is very important because it creates a higher risk versus a lower risk to a political settlement and a stable peace with a functioning state. I have some suggestions at the very end about what these temporary limited deviations from international norms and justice norms should be, and I hope we can discuss that. The purpose for that is to avoid, the worst thing you can do in counterinsurgency is to create anarchy, because then you have 20 or 30 years more of continued violence. You have the Congo, you have Somalia, and on a short, more short-term, limited basis, you have Baghdad as it was from 2003 to even now, I would say, although it's getting a little bit better. Now, finally, one thing is important in my approach. Conflict and peace process cannot be separated. The peace process occurs while the conflict is boiling, and during the peace process, there's more violence and more conflict occurring. So in an ideal world, you would say, well, I have a war here, I bring it to an end, and then I can do peace. In the real world, all these things happen at the same time. And anytime you have a peace process, it can be, again, undone by a recurring violent group or spell or outside intervention. Finally, the examples I give here in orally, although in my paper I have more, is based on the British response in Northern Ireland especially, and the U.S. Mode of counterinsurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the reason I emphasize these two countries because they, whatever they do, and they often act together, it has a bigger impact on what happens in the world, and also how international organizations like NATO or even UN peacekeeping operate than if I were to select, I don't know, how Spain deals with the Basques and the like. So I think that those are the important international actors, and that's why I emphasize them. Also, 30% of my paper is what I'm trying to present here. The other 70%, I'm sure, you can get on a website, which I sent you by email attachment. So these are the beginning. This is sort of the idea that I'm trying to get across in a very short time this morning. If I could have the next slide. Okay. We skipped one, but that's fine. No problem. Now, I just want to briefly say a few words here. In states versus insurgents, there is no symmetry or reciprocity. The insurgents have no chance of success waging conventional war against a more powerful adversary. They don't wear uniforms. They don't openly carry their weapons. They depend on the civilian population to provide food, funds, recruits, information about what the security forces are doing. And they need active support in retreating from attacks back into safe places or simply to merge and disappear in the population. If they do not get cooperation from the population by persuasion, they do it with intimidation, coercion, and fear. In fact, insurgents routinely, in many insurgency, you can show that they murder more civilians among their own people than the security forces kill in counterinsurgency operations. Those killed are called collaborators or traitors, though for the most part they are bystanders who do not actively support the insurgents, but the insurgents have need to keep them separate from the security forces and prevent any kind of information or collaboration between the two. Sometimes these bystanders are tortured before they are executed as a warning to others. So for the civilian population, unconventional warfare is terrible, horrible thing. Now for the unconventional warfare is also an unsettling experience for professional armies who are trained to fight other professional armies. The killing of their comrades by invisible snipers, landmines, roadside bombs, attackers and suicide bombers disguised as civilians, use of civilians as shields, religious places of worship, hospitals, schools, and civilian homes are used for weapons, caches, and attacks, and as safe places. The site of atrocities against civilians and their own soldiers, that is their mission to protect, puts a tremendous pressure on officers and soldiers and the authorities to find effective countermeasures at any cost. So the experience of officers and men at the grassroots of combat convince many of them that the laws of war make them vulnerable, while the laws of war protect the insurgents, that is the Geneva Convention, and are not a realistic and indeed a fair guide to waging war. And here I forgot to say something, is that the laws of war have been developed based on professional armies fighting professional armies, states fighting states. Normal peacetime justice has been created to deal with normal crime. Now, the topic that is being explored right now is how far these kinds of instruments that have been devised for specific purposes can actually be applied and used in these unconventional warfare. Oh, I have 5 minutes left. I have only begun. So I don't know what to do. Is really 5 minutes?
Maybe I talked about 10 minutes in advance, so I think you have still 10 minutes left.
Excuse me?
You talk about unconventionality, so your time would also be unconventional.
Okay, so in the rest of the paper, what I try to show is that the real problem of the of fighting counterinsurgency is intelligence and deep intelligence. And the security forces really don't know what's out there, who's the enemy. The only way they can get it is by obtaining it from the population. The population is being, as one French counterinsurgency colonel said in the Algerian War, when he arrested a known guerrilla and tried to make him give him information, and he said, "Mon capitaine, I'm not afraid of you. All you can do to me is put me in jail for a few years. If I talk to you, my comrades will slit my throat and slit the throat of my family. So guess what? I'm not going to talk to you." So in order to get information, though, there's tremendous pressure on the security forces to deviate both from the Geneva Convention and also from normal justice. And a whole crisis justice system is instituted and used, and the way that is done and the way that there's only limited, controlled, and legally sanctioned and judicial supervision for these deviations and departures makes a very great difference, as I said, for what happens if the insurgency is contained. I analyze here the way the British government handled the Northern Ireland insurgency in terms of crisis justice and also the military methods that they used, which in my opinion were far better to make these deviations temporary, limited, and not risking a final political solution and a stable peace process. The way the Bush administration and the U.S. military and the security apparatus handled the Iraqis and to some extent the Afghan case is much more puts the future political solution and stable society with a functioning state puts it much more at risk. And I argue in my paper by giving and analyzing these examples that we should be thinking about how to deal with counterinsurgency more using the British model rather than what the Bush administration model is. I think the Bush administration model is going to stay in place until they get Republicans get voted out of office in the next election. So you will see a change in the American method as well, but it will take some time, I'm afraid. Now, in conclusion, and I'm sorry I couldn't give you some examples and make a better case here orally, I will just say that the model I propose is not to junk the Geneva Conventions and a normal criminal justice system and say they don't apply, they're no longer valid in our world. I mean, a sort of a overreaction to the kind of threat that terrorism and insurgencies present in the world today. What I'm saying is we need these norms as a baseline, as an ideal that we can conform to and insist we should conform to in a peaceful world, in an ideal world. But we need these norms. On the other hand, in order to fight what I really consider evil, insurgency and terror, we need temporary deviations. These deviations should be limited, temporary, supervised by some kind of a judicial oversight and not by the executive branch and the military internally monitoring it, and that as you come to control the insurgency and you develop some kind of a stalemate that motivates everybody towards a political solution, you reestablish gradually the peacetime justice system and strict adherence to the Geneva Convention. So all I'm advocating, being a realist, and what you do in this messy world, is a limited, temporary, and always justified deviation that those who deviate have to be accounted for to both international public opinion and, of course, to the judiciary and maybe the legislature of their own country. That way, I think one can avoid chaos, anarchy, a failed state, which, to my mind, is the worst for the population, is the worst for the country, and is the worst for the international system. And that's what I'm trying to say should be avoided. And the means I'm suggesting are these. So thank you very much for being patient and listening to me.